Chapter 1, Part 1. Silvio knew he should be grateful. As far as he could see, wealth lay upon the land, rich in this autumn haze. He should be thankful there was grain to harvest, that mares foaled and raced, even now as he watched, across the plains that faded to the purple rise of foothills and then mountains. On his ancestors' bones he was grateful. It was just that a man could grow suspicious. A man could imagine. Given enough reason, a man could think anything. He unstrung the ewe-stave and left off tillering, his attention caught by his stallion, Ibachi. The chestnut horse sped arrow-swift across the meadows, in his wake a herd of mares and their foals. The stallion exemplified all the summary horses represented. Sturdy, hardy, quick, and sure. The yearlings would fetch a good price at the market in Rena. Shortly the drive would start. There would be brisk haggling for the finest horses on the continent. There would be grossy silver coins from Almery merchants, and grossy would pay off the increasing weight of taxes and help compensate the trade restrictions imposed by Rena when again they sat to discuss the flow of goods. As surely they would discuss, even dictate. Silvio knew this. That Grossi would be enough this time, he doubted. Money went only so far when dealing with such people. And there was that new tax his prince levied. He didn't want to think of that now. Not now. Not when there was this hope, this promise, after so much bitterness and betrayal. 10 years. Had it been so long? 10 years since Aldo's stroke, and his son had come to power. 10 years since Silvio left Rena amid rumour and rancour. And even after all this time, he had no proof of his suspicions, nothing but the instinct of his gut and the caution of his wife's gift. Aldo had suffered more than a stroke. There was some sinister purpose behind Carmelo's ascendancy to the throne, and it was because of Silvio's inquiries, his ever-so-diligent mind, that Carmelo reacted and banished Silvio from court. He could be wrong. There was always that hope. He wished for hope as he watched his wife, Aletta, below him in the fields, watched as she tied sheaves with deft movements. She straightened from stooking the sheaf with others, her hands on her back, arching. Likely she groaned from strain. Other figures were there with her, men and women of the village, all of them bent to the task of bringing in the barley. Like the horses, they were a hardy lot, quick to fly, but never flee. They would never flee. Not these rough, vibrant people. Like his wife, these villagers did their share to ensure the well-being of each other. They spun together. They planted together. Whatever skills they had were shared with the village. There was no other way, and Silvio could think of no other way. Time could do much to change a man's perspective. Aletta raised her gaze, scanning the fields as he watched her, following a similar path his own had taken, and he wondered if her thoughts strayed in the same direction, if she also wrestled with a sense of foreboding despite the bounty upon the land. And as he had, she sought out the figure of her spouse. Across the distance he caught her gaze, held it, felt once more that ineffable bond with her. Air and earth, stone and sky. Theirs was a song that carried over the fields, and Silvio felt its benediction, felt his apprehensions ease. Surely this beauty would not be blotted from the land. Surely, he thought. And he lifted his gaze to the landscape, to the rolling plains that stepped down and down to the sea beyond the horizon, to the villages dotted here and there, and then turned slowly, so he could see the mountains at his back. Immense they were, purple above the tree line, and encapped with snow where they pierced the sky so clear and blue a man could fall into it. All that was his world, set in the shadow of the mountains, that curved like a scythe from the south to the east. All was governed by them. Rain, trade, safety, and communication, all depended on the mountains of ice. Without them, Brina to the north would surely overrun Simmery rather than dance in a carefully orchestrated economic maneuver designed for political ends. At that, he turned again to the possibility of trade talks, of the threat those Brinais still posed, out there beyond the mountains, plotting his ancestors knew what. Like the mountains themselves they were, an immensity instinctive in the bones and never really known. Despite the sanctions they imposed, aye, despite the sanctions, Silvio was sure there was more to those Brinai than anyone imagined. Under the threat of increasing economic and political pressures, there were some Cimmeri who fled through those mountains, unable to afford passage around the isthmus and the continent to refuge in Almaray, the country to the west of the mountains that shared the peninsula with Cimmeri, and the pressures from the north in Brina. He wished them well, those pilgrims to a new life. He wished them peace and prosperity. Indeed, the past years had been hard. There was reason enough to flee, but he stayed. Aletta and he was sure he would always stay. There was too much of this land in his heart for him to leave. It was there in the villagers bringing in the harvest. It was there in the stave of yew under his hand. This stave of yew was something he knew. This he could coerce, cajole into something of beauty and value to his village and himself. Once he had encompassed more, shouldered more, had the weight of command and government and actions that dealt in very real human lives and very real human deaths. Once, not so long ago, with a different prince, in another life. Again he returned to the stave, his fingers lingering over the pale slivers of bone he'd laminated between layers of yew. Not just any bone there, the tibia of Vincenzo's sister. He felt like a ghoul, despite the respect he had gained as one of the rare few boyars who could make the legendary Arcosi. This was a skill he didn't seek. It sought him. And still he didn't understand how it was the dead could whisper to him, sigh in the background of his mind like whispers lost in the chatter of fall leaves. He traced the line of her bone, like a pale silver thread gleaming between layers of yew, feeling her spirit stir, aware of his reverence for the ancestors that watched over them all, and hoping they knew it was out of love for them and this land that he plied his trade. Beware! He jerked his hand away, heart pounding. What was this? He glanced around, seeking the person who spoke. Alone. He was alone here in the boyard. He shuddered, backed away from the unfinished bow, convinced he imagined the voice. Even at the best of times, he didn't like working the Arcosi, now even less. This bow proved difficult, the laminations fussy, the bones of Vincenzo's sister awakening sooner than the last time he'd fashioned a bow for her brother. It had been at Vincenzo's insistence her bones were dedicated to the bow shop. The more who heard her voice, the better, Vincenzo said. Gods, what had he become? A ghoul indeed, he was sure, that he should handle the dead in this fashion, work their bones into deadly grace. He didn't like being what he was. This wasn't part of the order of the world, he was sure. But still, he had this boon. To him, it seemed more a bane. At least when Minister of National Security, he dealt with tangibles. This was close to abomination, he was sure. And he had not asked for this ability. He had not wanted it. He rubbed his jaw, let go of a breath. But a man had to do something with his life when he found it dissolving. Stripped of his position in government, stripped of title, land, he found himself in the embrace of the very villagers over whom he'd had governance. And they, in turn, found him a place. He was grateful. Indeed, a man had to be grateful, for they risked much in accepting him into their fold. Il Principe Carmelo had not been impressed with Silvio's inquiries. 10 years ago. Carefully, he again touched the bow, lingering over the bone lamination. Beware, Silvio. The gods delight in play. This is too soon, he thought, and he wondered at the warning. Wondered what it could mean. He had done everything in his power to remain in the background, to draw no attention, to prove to his prince he was of no danger. He should have been able to reason with Carmelo. He had been the boy's mentor. Again, he reached for the bow. He's watching you. He jerked back his hand, truly alarmed now. Who watched? He glanced around. Fool, love can be hate. Even across the small distance, without his contact, Vincenzo's sister spoke, her bones vibrating so he thought the laminations would give way again. The bow settled, the voice gone. He wiped the sweat suddenly beading his brow. Carmelo, is that who watches? What threat could he, Silvio, pose to the throne here in Danuto, without influence, without power? Love can be hate. Indeed it could, but what reason had Carmelo to hate him? It had not always been so under the father, Aldo. There had been trust there. There had been friendship. He had been part of Aldo's extended family, a guide for the son, Carmelo. Carmelo, who had grieved silently, bitterly, for his dead mother, who had been caught trying to sever a finger from her corpse with the jewel dagger he always wore. Peace, he thought, reaching out to the bow again. Be still. He had the impression of ripples receding, a pool become placid. What was a man to think? What was a man to do? Once he would have had no reason for caution. He would have known what to do. But then he'd been another man when he'd started his career in Rina, full of the confidence and arrogance only youth can truly enjoy. He had sought glory, and thereby honor through the accolade's proximity to privilege granted, before the weight of decisions and the repercussions of actions made a man cautious. Before honor became bitterest gall. Before he'd been banished by the son who had claimed the crown and since then found himself pursuing a simpler dream, a quieter life. 10 years ago, and to him, still yesterday. Again he lifted the obsidian scraper onto the heel of his hand, approached the stave carefully, and shaved down the hearthwood delicately. It took only slight modifications at this point to tailor the bow into a weapon of perfection. He used to be a wielder of weapons. Now he was a maker. He used to be a maker of decisions. Now he was a deliberator. For a few moments, he drew the black blade across the wood, stood back when one of his apprentices joined him in the open air. Silvio looked over at the young lad, no more than 15 years at best, and already showing signs of being an adept. Well, boy? The lad all but twitched with excitement. Vincenzo's back. Silvio scanned the village, chiding himself that he had not seen Vincenzo's approach. His shop had a clear vantage of tidy squares of homes that stepped down the hillside, all of them tiled and constructed of good Cimmeri stone. Withy trellises bowed over the walkways, heavy with grapes. At the centre of the village was the well and the town square, around which grew a latticework of gardens riotous with flowers. It seemed a frivolity but for the bees they attracted. Throughout these trappings of the village were the people with whom he had lived since finding himself distanced from the political centre of his country. Leonora there, broad and gentle, with her boys and one shining daughter, washing clothes at the stone tubs. There Tullio, the old patriarch, where he sat in the shade of his orange tree, holding court with the young people and teaching sciences. And over the withy fence, in an arbor of wisteria, Donato with that slow-eyed Pina who was sure to be his undoing and joy. Beyond all this, set at a respectful distance, rose the modest temple to Norezza, her grove of trees and byres, ossuaries and silence enclosed in a brick wall. But nowhere could he see Vincenzo. Impatient, he asked, "Where? Is he well?" "He's in the shop. He has sacks and sacks of spider silk. He's well, yes, Maestro Silvio." Silvio set aside the scraper and hurried along the path to the shop, the boy in tow. "He says it's good silk, Maestro. He says he found lots. That means we'll be able to make Angeli strings again, eh, Maestro? Doesn't it? And it means the land's well, right? That must be right, or else those spiders," the boy shuddered, "wouldn't be weaving such big webs, would they? They're awfully finicky, eh, Maestro? It must mean things are okay." Silvio waved the boy to silence as he entered the door of the workshop, cursing his blindness after being in the bright sunlight. He could hear a babble of voices in front of him, discern bulky shapes. "Oh, Vincenzo, Vincenzo, we are here!" the boy shouted. "Maestro Silvio's come!" "Give over," Silvio growled, and the boy shut his mouth. To gentle his words, he ruffled the boy's hair. "Go on, go do something useful." By now, Silvio's eyes adjusted to the change in light, and he could see Vincenzo surrounded by the other boyars, in the center of the commotion a ring of children tugging and pulling. The large workshop was filled near to overflowing. For a moment, Silvio feared his pandemonium might upset a table where one of his apprentices had left the work of laminating human bone to a maple core for an arcoso. That particular boyar's husband died in a skirmish with the Brinai, a skirmish which, according to officials, never occurred. Such work was precious, sometimes years in the making. Thankfully, one of the crowd shooed people away from the table. Silvio breathed a little easier, although he glanced rapidly over the walls, where bows and staves were shelved, arrows bundled, and terracotta funereal urns of bones sat on the floor. Assured all was safe, his attention returned to the crowd. Vincenzo unslung his bow, a graceful arc of bone and sinew that had been made upon his sister's death. It had taken 2 years to fabricate, the first from her bones. Silvia wondered how it fared in the field, wondered what she said to her brother, if she spoke at all. He caught Vincenzo's attention, and the man smiled grandly, white teeth in a broad, tanned face. His riding leathers were powdered with the dust of the road, and the slack in his belt showed signs of haste and little time for meals. There were no new rents in his jupon, and for that at least, Silvio was grateful. "Oho, Maestro," Vincenzo said. "I've brought bounty." He turned to the children. "Let me go now. I have to see that old brute over there." The children giggled and parted, grinning up at Vincenzo and then looking in Silvio's direction. Their grins evaporated. Their laughter died. "See what you've done, you old reprobate," Vincenzo said, crossing to Silvio and embracing him heartily. "It's good to see you." "And you," Silvio replied. He held Vincenzo at arm's length, feeling the hardness of the man's arms. "You took your time." "Oh, aye, Ministro, but I've news aplenty." Silvio flinched at the old use of title. "Then come, we'll go join a letter for bread." Vincenzo raised a brow. "Don't trust what I have to say?" "Always, but I want a letter to hear your news." "Huh, as I said, I'm to be brought before the village strega. She'll curse me if I lie." He grinned warmly, broadly. But Silvio always knew when Vincenzo attempted to spare him. People didn't live this closely and not know. Together, they left the bow shop for Silvio's home where bread, wine and soft, new cheese were gathered, and from there headed down through the village. As they descended the streets, people hailed, eager for gossip, eager for news. Despite his impatience, Silvio paused, past pleasantries, watching as Vincenzo deftly skirted revealing anything of import. At last they broke out into the fields, where Aletta and the others still labored in the golden barley. She stood, tying a sheaf tucked under her arm. Her red skirts shifted in the light breeze, stray wisps of dark hair fluttering over her tanned face. Still Silvio was enchanted by her, still after all this time. She wasn't what could be called beautiful, but she was striking with those broad cheekbones and wide, carved lips. Her eyes were like obsidian, they were so dark, and could be as harsh at times when she flared to anger. Compact was how he thought of her, a neat, compact package. She had been treated with awe when he served as Minister of National Security in Rina, and it was because of her abilities he had been forewarned of the betrayal of his prince. Not for the first time, he wondered what the children would have been like could she have had them. Sturdy, like her, all of them with that uncanny ability she had that was the very reason she remained barren. She tried to explain it to him once. He didn't understand, but he loved her all the same. She looked up from her work, her voice cascading into laughter, husky and deep, when she saw them approach. "So my lover and his lackey come to ply me with drink, food and rustic manners." She set her hands on her hips. "Try, my sweet man, oh please do try." She pushed her forearm over her brow. "I hope you like the perfume of sweat." Laughter ran through those within earshot. Silvio smiled and pecked her on the cheek. She looked at him archly, seized his face between her rough hands, and kissed him soundly on the mouth. On his ancestors' bones, but she could fluster him. He took her hands in his, and withdrew his lips from hers, albeit reluctantly, his blood singing, as only she could make it sing, sweaty as she was. She smiled at him, one of her knowing, mysterious smiles, and turned to Vincenzo. "And this bag of bones? Looks fit enough for the bow shop. What do you say, innamorato? Look at the gleam in its eyes. A man lurks there. What say you, Silvio? Shall I test it?" Vincenzo set down the basket of breakfast and made the gesture for mercy. "Coward," she said, and embraced him warmly. "You look well, Aletta." "And you look like shit." "Ever the diplomat." "Would you have me any other way?" "No." Silvio set out the food upon the linen cloth, and with a gesture bade his wife and his friend join him. It was still soft upon the stubble, for which he was grateful. Watching Aletta, he remembered many of the occasions that had caused him to suffer the stings of lying on dry stubble, and remembering that, he remembered also it had been 2 years since there had been stubble to abrade his skin. There had been no grain, no harvest, only fields left scorched under the retreating tide of Brinai. Brinai, who hadn't raided, not officially, but the evidence had been there in the skill with which those men moved. Common brigands didn't operate the way those raiders had. Only trained specialists operated as they did. Silvio had good reason to know. He hadn't spent most of his life as Cimmeray's head of national security for nothing. "The harvest looks bountiful," Vincenzo said around a mouthful of bread. Aletta cast a glance over the fields, perched as they were on a small rise that overlooked the golden barley, the fields where hops wound round poles like gigantic pikes. "Bountiful, yes. The land has had an opportunity to rest, and all that firing did the earth good, despite our feelings on the matter." "It would seem the same could be said for the spiders," Silvio said. Vincenzo nodded, swallowing. "The tree spiders are back, yes. Spinning webs, the likes of which I've not seen in many years." "Big." "Big? There were some webs so large they spanned trees, some as big as 200 meters.
You exaggerate, Silvio mumbled.
He tells the truth, Aletta said, setting down the wine jug and watching Vincenzo carefully.
200 meters.
Silvio kept his astonishment under control, wondering what it could mean that the spider spun such large webs.
Well, at least we'll be able to make Angeli strings.
Vincenzo nodded.
I have a plentiful harvest. We'll be able to fit a large percentage of the bows for trade with Angeli.
He sipped from the wooden beaker of wine.
How look our goods for trade?
Good.
Good goods, Aletta said. Information, my love. It helps in conversation when you provide information.
Silvio grunted.
I was getting to it.
Aletta let out a cluck of exasperation.
We are going to have grain to trade, Silvio said, throwing Aletta a frown.
That will be a first in 2 years. Should fetch a good price at market in Rina.
And horses, Aletta said. The foals from last year are proving healthy yearlings.
And horses, Silvio agreed. And it would appear that we are also going to have a good selection of bows, many with Angeli strings.
Some with Angeli strings.
Any decision on selling the Arcossi? Vincenzo asked.
The Arcossi.
Debate among the boyars and the villagers about selling the Arcossi had been passionate and divided. There were some archers who swore there were voices in their heads when they used the bows Silvio made, telling them how to draw, where to aim, when to loose. And pressed, Silvio admitted there was something uncanny about them, of having images like memories swim through his head as he carefully sliced thin veneers from the bones, glued bone to wood, tillered and teased a laminated stick into a weapon of deadly, almost sentient grace. It hadn't been until he'd worked with Vincenzo's sister's bones that he could attest to hearing voices. Now today's occurrence, that disturbed him. To offer the Arcossi at market was to sell the bones of one's mother or father, one's daughter or son. It was like peddling holy relics. Here, come on the finger bone of the goddess Vitalia, and protect yourself from infertility. Here, come by this Arcosso that was my brother, and thwart your enemies.
They've agreed, said Silvio.
But it was bitter, said Aletta.
I can imagine, said Vincenzo, and he looked out across the fields. Silvio could speculate what the other man thought, the conflict of emotions and reasons. Vincenzo himself used an Arcosso. Silvio made it for him from a prime yew stave he'd been saving, and the bones of Vincenzo's sister, who had died resisting Brina's security measures. He had seen it all through her eyes as he'd made the bow, disturbing images, flights of darkest fantasy, from his own overwrought mind, he was sure. It was what had made him a master boyar, and brought hopeful apprentices to his door. He very much suspected that which he couldn't explain with logic. And he was determined to find out why her bones affected him so profoundly. She had run the local inn, brewed some of the finest beer that was ever taken to trade in Rina. Exactly what security threat a brewer and innkeeper could pose, Silvio didn't know. All he knew was she had been targeted by the Brinai government, but he suspected she had only been an expendable gaming piece on a board filled with more valuable objectives. It was Silvio's suspicion it had been a warning to him. Arrogance? He didn't think so. He'd been a vocal dissenting voice when in office, against allowing Brina preferred trading rights, against harmonization of the two countries' security systems to comply with the Brinai system. Such an action would have left Cimmeri little more than an economic vessel. That a brewer and innkeeper had acted as a terrorist agent, especially one as non-political as Vincenzo's sister had been, Silvio doubted. It was a ploy, nothing more. Now Donato, her brother and Vincenzo's, ran the inn, and likely soon Pina would join him. Donato still brewed beer. It was good beer, certainly fine beer, but somehow not the same as the thick, dark brew that had won so much acclaim. So that leaves the question of when do we leave for Rina, Vincenzo said. Silvio stroked his jaw, considering. likely a week, maybe two, three at the outside. Time to put together some Angelus strings.
And organize who's going and who's not, Aletta said.
There will have to be a village council. This concerns us all. We'll have to approach the sindaco.
Sindaco Antonio Portelli was Cimera's acting politico and landed aristocrat in the village of Danuto, generally an innocuous man, mostly ambivalent to the requirements of his office. For the most part, he oversaw his woolen mills and left the governing of Danuto to the informal elected council, and skirted around the issue he'd been given Silvio's confiscated station and holdings, and while doing so, managed to keep the balance of harmony in the village. It had been at Portella's insistence Silvio take the Casa Portelli, while it had been at Carmelo's insistence Portella take Silvio's as required by Carmelo's edict.
I'm sure we can pull him away from the mill for a short time, especially with the promise of coin for his cloth, Silvio said.
Vincenzo nodded.
And what about taxes for our beloved prince?
And there was the knot of the problem. Alleging increased costs for security, public works and administration, that beautiful boy of prince, Carmelo III of Cimere, had done everything he could to ensure his own silks were the best, his stable bountiful, his private herd of deer stocked, and lands secured. It was said even hoods of his hawks were cloth of gold. And this while the country sank under the depredations of raids and the slow decay caused by negligence. Many of the main roads were now so pitted it made transport by cart and wagon difficult, sometimes ruinous. Brigands raided along with the Brenii, leaving merchants little choice but to retain either their own protection or hire mercenaries, because hope of the well-trained policing unit that had been prevalent under his father's reign and Silvio's authority had all but evaporated. Transfer payments from the crown to the states had diminished to nearly nil, so that maintenance of public wells and sewers and baths had fallen down the list of priorities. Public servants had been cut and retired to the point any bureaucrats left were overworked and unlikely to be helpful to the very people who paid such exorbitant taxes to keep them employed. And now there was the new tax. Nothing was exempt. Not food, not land, not even the wages a person made by the sweat of their own brow. 20%. 20% before you could even begin to calculate your cost of goods, your overhead, and cost of living. It was a ruinous tax, and Silvio was now convinced if the Brenii didn't outright annex Cimere, their own crown prince would bleed them dry and incite riot, perhaps civil war. And with the Senate nothing more than toadies to Carmelo's whims, there was little hope of meaningful opposition to a reign of ruin. Silvio nodded, considering. To meet with Sindaco Portelli sooner would be better than later. There was much to organize, much to discuss, and the time they had left before Rina's annual market would be cutting things fine.
I'll go to him, he said, not relishing the prospect.
You're sure? Aletta asked. He glanced over at her, aware she probably heard the reluctance in his voice, and not for the first time was disconcerted at the thought.
I'm sure. Better me.
Then when?
Tomorrow morning.
She smiled. Let the rest of the day remain relatively unruffled.
Can you blame me?
She laughed, reaching over and squeezing his hand. Innamorato, I can blame you for very little but the theft of my heart.
He grunted his embarrassment and avoided Vincenzo's grin.
And what other news have you?
Vincenzo's grin evaporated.
Only observations. He looked back out across the fields. It seems odd there are more incidents of brigand attacks near the Brina Pass than on the road.
You ventured that far?
Vincenzo nodded.
The tree spiders tell you a lot if you pay attention to their clues.
That's where you found the huge webs?
Again Vincenzo nodded.
They are laying traps where there's plentiful food supply because of corpses and movement of anything living.
And you don't think the predations at the pass and of the road are from ordinary common criminals? Ordinary common criminals don't kill their victims and overlook jewelry and money pouches. And they certainly don't leave anyone living with any weapons.
You're questioning their motives, Aletta said.
I am. Why do this? Why this seemingly pointless exercise in destruction? Why not just invade?
Because, said Silvio, to invade would catalyze the support of Almaray, and that would mean not only land troops, but an excellent navy. Even now, even with our own security in disarray, enough time hasn't passed that troops and measures couldn't be mobilized and implemented. Breena would have a relatively even fight on their hands. But if they were to invade, with Almaray coming to our aid, Breena would face a war they couldn't win. So, better to undermine a politically weak country through economic and politic means. Tie them up in trade agreements that keep the flow of natural resources and finished goods moving north into Breena at preferred rates so that profits are reduced, and thereby depleting the growth and prosperity of Cimmeray. Less profits means less disposable income to the people, who then become more and more reliant upon government subsidies. And government subsidies aren't going to happen because Breena is totally cognizant, as are we all, that the current government has relinquished all responsibility to the fiscal health of the country. So Breena, in a gesture gilded in terms of peace and cooperation, inveigled themselves into the very fabric of our security and economic systems.
Conquest through economic and political invasion, Vincenzo said.
Exactly. And those brigand raids are part of it. How far south do they seem to have gone?
Imalfia.
That was a shock. Imalfia lay south of Danute by another 40 kilometers.
You saw them?
Vincenzo shook his head.
No. I had an interesting discussion with the innkeeper there. He showed me the arrows found in the bodies left behind by the brigands. Somebody made a tactical error.
The arrows were fletched with vulture feathers.
Vincenzo nodded.
And the Brinai are known to fletch with vulture feathers. That was a tactical error.
He considered.
Or maybe not. But I can't believe they'd be that arrogant. Not yet. They haven't secured their economic targets yet.
He looked over to Aletta.
I think Danuta's trip to market this year is going to be very interesting.
I think I should go with them, she said.
I was hoping you'd say that. They could use your ears, Aletta.
She laughed. But how ever will you survive without me?
Silvio flushed.
It's only a few weeks.
There's more, Ministro, Vincenzo said.
Silvio raised his eyebrows, watching the unease on Vincenzo's face.
I wondered when you would get to that, Aletta said.
Vincenzo shot her a glance.
You knew?
She smiled.
I heard.
Vincenzo nodded. Silvio watched as Vincenzo drew a sealed canvas envelope from his vest, his calloused hand very dark against it.
I met a courier from Reno on my way home to Danuto.
Silvio stared at the seal upon the envelope, unwilling to accept what Vincenzo offered. That seal was a funeral urn upon a blazing sun. None other than the royal seal. He felt a letter stiffen beside him.
How is it you come by this packet? Silvio asked.
It would seem even our Principe's messengers are easily frustrated and compromised. I offered to pay his considerable bar bill when our paths crossed at an inn.
Reluctantly, Silvio took the envelope, cracked open the seal, and read the contents of the letter. The usual flourish of titles and greetings, obviously written by Carmelo's scribe. A little further along, he stopped reading, cold with the menace he knew lay in those words.
"What is it?" Aletta asked.
"Silvio, you've gone pale."
"I am summoned to Reno this year. Seems Il Principe regrets having stripped me of titles and lands and wishes to redress his actions." He could feel the shock in his wife and his friend. After all this time, summoned to Reno, alleged reparation. When he'd been dismissed from office, Carmelo had been incoherent with rage, then inconsolable in his grief, begging Silvio not to leave him, not to abandon him, All the while his crippled father, Aldo, stood in the shadows behind the throne. The former Principe leaned on the intricately carved staff that had become his trademark after he'd recovered from the stroke. He never spoke. He walked with a pronounced limp. Rarely did one ever see his face, robed and hooded as he remained since that fateful day. Silvio remembered thinking how Aldo resembled one of the Cucullati, the robed and hooded spirits that guided people from life to death, except that Aldo didn't wear the distinguishing red. The day of Silvio's banishment, Carmelo said he needed fresher, unjaded minds working around him, his grief forgotten. Silvio made the mistake of speaking his opinion, and finding himself exiled, without title, his family's lands confiscated by the crown. Now Carmelo wanted him back. That it was a true change of heart, Silvio doubted. There was more here. He didn't know what yet, but he would soon.
"You're not going to go," Aletta protested.
"I agree, Ministro," Vincenzo said. "This doesn't sit right." "I know it doesn't, but I am going." He looked up at them. "How can I not? If I don't, that will cause more harm than good. Who knows what Carmelo will do? He could send an armed guard for me, and then all my ability to find out what he's up to will be thwarted."
"But Silvio..."
I know, Aletta. This could be a trap of some sort. But why? What possible threat can I be to him?"
"You are loved by the people, Silvio. You..."
"And do you see me surrounded by an army, threatening to overthrow him, assassinate him? I've kept all the conditions of my banishment. I haven't been to Rina in 10 years. I am not involved in any military activity." "We have done everything to be sure of that," Vincenzo said. "Although you and I both know, without your acumen, I'd be lost organizing Danuta's retainers and patrols." Silvio dismissed that with a grunt. "I have no power. I have no lands. I have no capital to retain mercenaries. The closest I've come to anything military is to make bows."
"But rare bows, you have to concede that."
"The Arcosi, indeed. Rare bows. Bows he did not wish to make, but felt compelled. The funeral urns which had been dedicated to the bow shop sometimes vibrated with incoherent whispers as he passed. Whispers he knew only he and others like him could sense. He didn't like having this ability. He didn't want to be part of something that couldn't be explained, tracked, quantified. And having that ability very much marks him as someone unusual. Unusual enough to have Carmelo summon him." He groaned in frustration, thrust a letter at a letter. "Can you feel anything? Anything at all?" She took the paper and the canvas envelope, inhaled deeply, let her rough hands touch the words. He watched concentration set her features, watched the emotion slide away as she sank into her own gift. Then abruptly she refolded the letter, placed it back into the canvas envelope, and handed it back to Silvio.
"Well?"
She shook her head.
"No?"
"No. It's not that I can't read anything, hear anything. It's that there's something else there, some other... I don't know. If I didn't know better, I would say there was power here. Power as I've never known before, heard before. But all that knowledge was outlawed and then destroyed long before our ancestors were born." She looked at him intently. He could tell how much this cost her to remain calm, to be the Strega, not the wife. "And knowing there is something hidden here suggests dark dealings, suggests secrets, and perhaps danger. Beyond that, I am unable to tell you anything of use."
"Then that settles matters. I'm going to Rina. We'll be sure to take our best retainers, spread our information net, but not leave Danuto unguarded. Whatever Carmelo wants of me, I'll not see innocent people put at risk."
And from there, Silvio led his friend and his wife into discussion of Vincenzi's recent travels, of news, of matters of no import, and general gossip. his attention was on little of it. His mind raced ahead to the sequence of events that might or might not unfold in the next few weeks, and what lay down the road at market in Rena.